Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. I have with me today, for the first time ever, I don't know why it's taken so long, but the one, the only, Ken Milne from the S-Gym. And who better to introduce himself than Ken? Ken, can you introduce yourself briefly to like maybe the one or two people out there who's listening to Total EM but hasn't heard you before?
Hi, my name's Ken Milne. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you, Chip. I'm an emergency physician in Canada. Been doing research for over 30 years. I'm passionate about skepticism and knowledge translation. And it got to such a point that I created my own knowledge translation project called The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Too modest of an intro. The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine is an amazing podcast. And if you haven't actually ventured there yet, I'd highly encourage it. Not that I'm biased at all. I've only been on there a few times, but I've enjoyed it. And Ken really knows the research and he takes the deep dive on every paper. And that's just, it's impressive. I enjoy it each time. But we're here to talk about a very special issue because if you notice, we've hit the big 5-0 today. And nonetheless, on the 4th of July. And who better to celebrate that with the Canadian?
Well, you know what I thought about, Chip? Not only do you have a Canadian on the 4th of July for your 50th, but I just turned 50. And so it just seems like the whole world is coming together in some cosmic karma.
Well, a big happy birthday there.
Thanks. I was going to do some theme music like Hawaii 5-0. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Without further ado, I guess we should actually get to what we're talking about today, and that is evidence-based medicine. Ken is one of the experts out there on evidence-based medicine and the way of turning it into a podcast. And that's a big deal because anyone could literally buy a microphone, record some audio, and then put it up on the internet for everyone to share. But what's the big difference between someone who randomly picks up a microphone and starts talking about medicine versus someone who goes down the evidence-based pathway? And none other do we look at our friend here, Ken, for some guidance, because Ken is actually who I learned from when it came to podcasting and it came to actually using the BEAM method to being able to better understand evidence-based medicine. So I was hoping to have Ken on to talk about some of the key points of evidence-based medicine. How should we take literature and better understand it? And basically everything related to that when it comes to FOMED.
Yeah, well, Chip, you pointed out something right there in your introduction, and that is podcasting, it's just a tool, right? And so the tool can be used for great good, like what you're doing, or it can be used for other things. Remember, I'm a Canadian, so I'm not going to say bad things about people, but it's just a tool. And so it's how you use the tool. And I'm trying to use the tool to disseminate evidence-based medicine, knowledge translation, skeptical thinking, critical appraisal skills. But ultimately, I just want people to be able to give the best care to the patients that they're taking care of based on the best evidence.
And you hit one of the biggest things, which is why I think most of us are doing this podcasting, and that is because of knowledge translation. Most of us are out here because we want to share our knowledge, and pretty much all of us, as Scott Weingart mentioned at the podcasting course, we're all really introverts, but when it comes down to it, we have gone another step, and we've actually decided to share our information with the world and share what information we've learned from others. And so a big part of that is to try and actually cut down that KT window, which, Ken, I know you love talking about the KT window.
Oh, I love talking about the KT window. And I'm always quoting saying it can take over 10 years for high quality, clinically relevant information to reach the patient's bedside. The actual number is actually 17 years, like we have precision on that. And it's not for 100% of the information. It's actually only for 14% of the information. So it takes over 10 years for high quality, clinically relevant information to reach the patient's bedside. And in the age of social media and electronic communication, that is just way too long.
Think about that for a second. A lot of us who are out there doing the research or learning as much as we can from the papers, there's no way we're going to be able to cover all of it. But what happens when we go to a new site or we start our career off or whatever the case may be, and we're saying, man, it feels like they're practicing 30, 40 years ago medicine. Maybe we're not exactly off here because, again, the knowledge translation taking so long as it is right now. But thanks to FOMED and thanks to social media in general, we're able to cut down that KT window. And with the SGIM goal is to cut it down to less than 1 year, right, Ken?
1 year, under 1 year. That's the goal.
So with that in mind, how do we best take information that's out there, such as Total EM or such as SGIM, and know that this is good, valid information?
Well, I don't think there's, you know, one good way or right way or correct way for knowledge translation, because it can be transmitted in different ways and people will consume it in different ways and find it useful. But I think what you're trying to get at is, how about the quality? And that's the thing that always comes up. How do you figure out quality? And when it comes to social media, blogs and podcasts, actually Brent Toma, and I was on the paper, one of the papers, but Brent Toma is really leading the charge in this, and he's come up with two papers, and those papers are how to assess the quality of a podcast or how to assess a quality for a blog. So he's trying to find some structure. Now, there's challenges with that, and there's some pushback on that, because some people say, well, you know, it's kind of like art. I can look at the picture and I'm, yeah, that's good. Or I can look at the picture and yeah, no, that's not so good. So when it comes to evaluating podcasts and blogs, I think one of the ways is, are they giving you useful information? And is that information actually improving the care of the patients that you take care of? And if you get repeat after repeat after repeat positive experience, then you gain their, that provider, you gain trust in them, and it leads to relevance, and you keep going back to that same well again to get that information.
That's a really concise way to put what is a very difficult topic. As you said, Brent Toma is doing such a wonderful job with it. And I understand there's some debate there, because maybe some of the points aren't things that you could easily do in a subjective versus objective manner. And ultimately, though, one of the things to look at is basically who the author is and what their knowledge set is and what they cite, and making sure that they're actually giving good information. Now, one thing I'll admit, and maybe this is something I need to get better at, Ken, I've debated this myself. My show notes, I try and put all the links to the information I put in there. But it's not like EM Nerd, for example, or Rebelcast, where they actually go through and they put all the citations in like an APA-type format at the end. For me, that's just not my style, and I've always hated APA format or MLA, and I hope my wife's not listening right now. But that format for me is just not as natural. But what I do is I make sure I link to like PubMed, where it's a permanent source or something like that, some way so that the papers can always be tracked back, or my sources can at least be better found, because I understand that can change with time. So what are your thoughts on that part?
Well, you raised a few points in there, and one of them was, you know, who the author is. So where is that information coming from? And are they somewhat of an authority figure on that information? And then, are they being transparent about conflicts of interest? I think that's really important. I mean, who's paying for this? Who's the money, behind the podcast? And, you know, we both do this as part of FOMED. So all of the stuff I'm doing is free and nobody pays me to do it, and I'm free from any conflicts of interest that I'm aware of. So I think that's an important point. And then having those links, having those external links so that people can go back and actually click on them. And I agree with you. I don't necessarily need to get that formal and put the proper citation format. As long as I've got a link back to the original article in PubMed, I'm happy that people can actually go back and look at what I've referenced. But of course, you know, at the end of every single podcast, I put a disclaimer, and that disclaimer is to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. So I'm always hammering away at saying, don't believe anything I tell you. Don't believe anything anybody tells you. Learn about it. Read it. You still have to do the work. You can't, FOMED is not a fast track for, cracking open your brain and pouring that foamy goodness in. You still have to do the work, and it still has to be engaging and make you think. And then you will know how to take care of patients.
Well, and you bring up a couple of really great points. And one of them is that you talked about basically making sure there's no conflicts. And since the last time we've talked, Ken, I actually have now a Bandwidth sponsor.
I
now,
saw
the Bandwidth
that.
Sponsor has nothing to do with the content that was made very clear. They are literally just helping support the podcast because they believe in it so much. And then we have a little snippet that just says, hey, thanks to FunnyRx for being our sponsor. That's literally it. And I made it very clear with that, that this is all it stands for. So if you've heard this for the first time and you realize that that's on there, it's just like Ken said, we own our information. We still do that. And there's no conflict there. I made sure that who I picked up my Bandwidth sponsor isn't someone who would actually care in that sense what it was. So it's not like a drug company. I'm not going to mention any drug companies by name. Even though I'm not Canadian, I still try and be nice sometimes. but I don't do that kind of thing. I believe it's a good idea that if you can do it, because as you know, podcasting is not cheap. And so I want to give the information out there, but sometimes we just have to have a little bit of support to help make the difference in getting the listeners what they need.
Well, when are we going to start talking about evidence-based medicine? I mean, that's...
Oh, my gosh.
You know, that's what we're here for. Got way off track and started talking about podcasting and FOMED and all that kind of stuff. What about EBM, my favorite topic, or, well, one of my favorite topics?
Well, I guess you should lead us off there. Can you tell us a little bit about what exactly EBM is?
Well, I think we need to start with a definition because every time, okay, I don't like to use absolutes, almost every time that I talk about EBM or evidence-based medicine, people think that it's about the literature, and it is about the literature, but the actual original definition from Dave Sackett was that EBM was the conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of the current best evidence in making decisions about the care of individual patients. And I don't want to be, I'm not better than David Sackett, but the only thing I would have added in this new era would be to say in making shared decisions about the care of individual patients, because I like making shared decisions with patients. But really what that comes down to is a Venn diagram that I'm always explaining. And that Venn diagram includes the literature. That's one of the circles in the Venn diagram. But also in that Venn diagram is clinical judgment. You as the provider who are giving that care have to bring your clinical judgment. So that is not excluded from evidence-based medicine. And then, of course, patients' values and preferences have to be considered. So when you look at what evidence-based medicine is, it really is an overlap of clinical judgment, the patient's values and preferences, and then the literature, it guides us, it instructs us, but it doesn't dictate what we do. It doesn't say thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do that. It just guides our care so that patients can get the best care.
Can we go ahead and give an example of one of those? One example I like, let's go with back pain for a second. We know that there have been multiple studies recently that have been coming out, and we've got stuff on Total EM and stuff on the S-Gym about it, but about back pain. And naproxen seems to work as well alone as, say, oxycodone or cyclobenzaprine. And then there was another study with diazepam. All those studies is basically those drugs didn't seem to have any extra benefit, but there were lots of exclusions. And those exclusions are important because that's one more reason why clinical judgment and then the patient specifically that's in front of you. I am still finding myself at times prescribing certain medications for certain patients with back pain. Now, I keep in mind what the literature says, but that's not the only thing. I'm saying you shall not get anything else besides naproxen because that was the only thing that was used in the study that was helpful. It's this person specifically may benefit from naproxen the most, but they have some other things going on that I feel like they deserve X, Y, or Z medication as an attempt to further control their symptoms. And so I'm not ignoring the evidence base. I'm not ignoring the patient. I'm not ignoring my own clinical judgment. I'm taking all three together. And like you said in that Venn diagram, just combining and finding the right combination for that specific patient with shared decision making.
And what, you know, you're talking a little bit about the hierarchy of evidence-based medicine. And again, people sort of get excited about, is there really a hierarchy? But there's this pyramid representing the hierarchy of evidence-based medicine. And, you know, it starts at the bottom with expert opinion or in my experience or case reports. And then it gets into observational studies. And then mid-level is the randomized control trial. And above a randomized control trial, then you get into systematic reviews and meta-analyses. But that's actually not the highest level of care and or the highest level of evidence. And what you were describing potentially can be, because I don't treat a whole population. I don't treat a systematic review of thousands and thousands of patients. I treat people one at a time as individuals. And that highest form of evidence as a randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled crossover trial with an N of one. Because what I care about is it going to work for them, or what are the harms they are going to have? Not a population, not a cohort, not a big group. What I care about is that one patient in front of me. And is this intervention going to have net benefit or net harm?
And I feel like some people, when they listen to this, they are going to feel like maybe they're in the matrix or something, because they're trying to figure out, wait, I thought you just said that the evidence matters, and now you're saying that the evidence doesn't really matter to the patient in front of me. But it's really both, you know, and that's the tricky part sometimes, is that we have to remember that we need to look at this patient, this specific situation, but let's not discard the evidence at the same time. Let's not discard our experience, and let's not discard the patient. So it's tricky to get that perfect balance in there, in that hierarchy. I knew you were going to get the hierarchy in there somehow. Good plug. But RCTs, just like you said, they're not the top. But why is it in so much of research we rely on the RCT as the end-all be-all?
Well, because there's so many biases that come in with lower forms of evidence, and lower forms of evidence aren't necessarily wrong. And so when we talk about the hierarchy of evidence, we've got to talk about biases, and, you know, the biases that are systematic. And when I say bias, what I mean by bias is something that systematically removes us or moves us away from the truth. And what we're looking for is the truth. And so if you have observational studies, there's lots of different things that can come into that that can have bias. And then when you get into randomized control trials, again, there are actually things that limit the power of a randomized control trial. And just because systematic reviews are higher forms of evidence, one of my EBM mentors, one of my mentors, is famous for saying 2 third graders doesn't equal a 6th grader. So if you put 2 crappy studies together, it doesn't mean you get a better study in a systematic review and meta-analysis. Since I grew up in the country, I say, you know, adding a cow pie to an apple pie doesn't make the apple pie taste any better. So, you know, it really, again, even with the hierarchy of evidence, you have to be skeptical, and you have to have a tool set to do critical appraisal. And that's what I, you know, that's one of the nerdy things that I'm trying to embed into my podcast and my knowledge translation thing, is that you don't just actually get the content. You also get some skills. You get some ways to evaluate the literature, so that when you're reading something, all of a sudden, that skeptical radar can go off.
Well, and for people who are listening to the podcast and haven't heard the S-Gym before, I'd highly recommend to go back to the early podcasts, especially because all of it's great stuff, all of its papers are relevant, and they're still relatively new in nature. But I really love that if you're not someone who's strong in understanding evidence and how to dive through and dissect literature, you did a great job giving a lot of information there on how to take a piece of information and what does it mean to have this type of trial? What does it mean when they use this type of criteria? You know, it's just amazing, the breakdown there.
That's why the quality checklist is so important, because it's spaced repetition. So people on each one, they know that when they listen, they're going to get the same sort of thing, and that we have quality checklists that can evaluate the threats to the validity of the study. And then people will know, for observational trials, for randomized control trials, for systematic reviews and meta-analyses, for diagnostic studies, what are those questions that could threaten the validity? And then, of course, we get to my favorite part, and that's when we get to talk nerdy and get a little deeper into some of those biases and some of those limitations.
I love the talk nerdy section because you want the favorite things?
What's that?
The number of things you talk about.
Oh, my favorite number. It's 5. Yes, I'm on a podcast, but I'm holding up my hand for 5. I hope I never have some kind of trauma where I can only hold up 4 fingers, because then I'll have to change that section to 4 things.
No, no, you still have the other hand or toes.
Oh, yes, I could. Well, yeah, and let's leave it at that.
One more thing, because we're talking about this, is that we talked about RCTs and we talked about meta-analyses, but I think one that we forget about, and sometimes it's hard to digest this literature, but Cochrane reviews. Cochrane reviews are very helpful, but sometimes they're hard for us to digest and understand what exactly they're talking about. But they can be some of the best evidence out there. However, just like you were talking about, there can be real limitations to a Cochrane review. If all the literature is bad, if there's no good quality data out there, doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to get a definite answer from a Cochrane review. So just because it's a Cochrane review doesn't mean it's going to be the best. It's usually the best information that you have out there at the time, but doesn't mean it's perfect information.
Yeah. One of my other mentors, Dr. Jerry Hoffman, would always make some, and I'm going to paraphrase him here. We'd say, oh, well, we searched the world literature and found 130,000 studies, and we eliminated all the ones that didn't, and we got it down to 2 studies, and we found it down to 18 decimal points. You know, just because you mash stuff up doesn't mean, you know, it's the illusion of precision. And you have to look at the quality of the ingredients going into that mashup or that recipe or that meta-analysis. And so, you know, Cochrane is one of the most reputable sites for systematic reviews and meta-analyses. But, you know, if the ingredients are bad, if the heterogeneity is so high, should the studies actually be combined? Are they so different? So, you know, there's always another layer. Evidence-based medicine, it's like an onion. Actually, it's like a parfait, and everybody loves parfait.
All right. Well, let's take this parfait to the next step then. What should we be doing with EBM, and how do we decide what to incorporate?
You know, it's a great question. How do you do it? Because there's something close to 4,000 publications in PubMed every day. And so it's really a way of filtering the signal to the noise. And how do you do that? So you really, there's a 5-step process actually to how to do evidence-based medicine or the critical appraisal process. And you have to start with a question. I have a question. It's usually a clinical question. I saw a patient, or I'm seeing a patient. It's like, oh, how am I going to handle this? And so then you've got to formulate a question about what's the population? In other words, what's the patient? What intervention am I considering? What would it be compared to? And what was the outcome? Because that's how you frame your question. And then you go searching the literature, and you've got to have good searchable skills. So how do you go searching the literature? And then you try to find your highest level of evidence. So you want to find something that's high up on that pyramid that's good quality. And then you go through a checklist. And it doesn't have to be so formal that it has to be were these emergency department patients? Check. Oh, were there adequate randomization? Check. I mean, you can get a gestalt by looking at a paper. If they said, we had a double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trial, you're like, okay. But if they say, we had an unblinded, observational, pharma-funded, surrogate outcome study, I'm like, okay, you lost me already. And then after you go through that, then you reflect on it and you say, is this enough to change my practice? And very few things are, actually, because I think most of the big strides in medicine have been made. We have made some of the hugest gains early on. And I think now we're in the margins, and we're pushing those margins farther and farther to get better and better care. But I think those are incremental. They're not huge, as you say down there. It's not huge changes. They're incremental changes. And so, that's how I would approach, using evidence-based medicine. And then you find great podcasts, like your podcast is phenomenal. And I keep recommending it to as many people as I run into, out there, saying, you know, you've got to listen to this. This is great stuff that you're putting out. And then you filtered some of the information and you've given it to them in a digestible form. And if you're credible, honest, and transparent, they'll keep coming back and your audience will continue to grow and grow.
For the record, I did not have to pay Ken to say any of that, and I appreciate it. But one thing that you tie in there that I just want to throw out real quick is people can say, well, all right, I know how to look this up and I know how to incorporate this, but let's say I'm the student or the lower man on the totem pole. This is a new area for me. This is always one of the hard things to figure out. you see the evidence, and especially if you're a new person or new to this situation, it's not that you have a fund that you can just say, well, this is my fund of experience, or this is my fund of knowledge, this is what I'm going to do. How do we actually expand that to the next step, which is how do we get others in our practice or in our setting to help incorporate new evidence?
There's the Pathman Pipeway. It's called the leaky pipe, and it actually talks about, you know, why are there all these leaks in the pathway? And five of them are on the provider side, and two of these leaks for that high quality, clinically relevant information reaching the patient's bedside are on the patient's aspect. And so, first of all, the first leak is awareness. And if you're not aware, and if your colleagues aren't aware of a paper that just came out on the ceiling effect of ketorolac, you don't need 30 milligrams for that analgesic effect. Actually, 10 milligrams is adequate because that's the ceiling for ketorolac. Well, if they're not aware that that paper was just published by Sergei Motov, then that's something that you can do. You can make them aware of it. Then they have to think, can they accept that information? Do they think that that information is relevant? Can they apply it? Can you get 10 milligram vials for ketorolac in your department, or do they all come in 30 milligrams? And are they able to act upon it? And those are the next two steps. And then, of course, you've got to bring the patient into it because their values and preferences come into it. So they have to agree to the treatment and they have to adhere to it. And that's how Pathman described it. So basically, I think of it as you've got to change culture. And if you're going to change culture, I think it starts with leadership and advocacy and showing a passion for what you do and always, always coming back to what's in the best interest of the patient. And if you're doing what's in the best interest of the patient, you'll always be doing the right thing.
What I love there about what you're just talking about, because it's a perfect example, the ketorolac specifically, because that's a recent post that you made on the SGM, and that's a very recent paper, is that this is something that I've been working on a little bit based on some prior evidence. And thankfully, thanks to FOMED Resources, some of the people who I practice with heard that paper, listened to the podcast, read the paper itself, and they started incorporating it. And it's funny that awareness is a big part. But then I get other people in other situations where sometimes we talk about specific evidence and we go over it and talk about it amongst ourselves. And they have the issue of how do I incorporate it for myself, where that being that person, where they say, well, this doesn't actually fit my practice for whatever reason. And I'll give an example with ramping patients. I still have some people who believe when they intubate that they're going to be best doing it in the sniffing position. And they say a lot of times that it's because, well, I've always done it this way. I'm very comfortable with this. I'm afraid if I ramp, I'm not going to be as effective with it. I'm not going to understand the views. And so they usually don't do it. And sometimes it's funny, we slowly worked it out because if, say, I do the airway instead or something happens there, they'll observe it and they'll see how it can be done, just as one example. And sometimes that's enough to push them over the edge if they think it is something that may be potentially beneficial for them. So I like how you incorporate that in there, because that leaky pipe that you're describing right there is a common issue. And if you can figure out those points, you can plug the pipe a little bit at a time and start getting a little more information to the right people.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's really, really important. But there are always, Chip, going to be people that are early adopters and people that are laggers and everybody in between. I'm trying to remember one quote. There was something that said there's three types of people in the world: people that make things happen, people that watch things happen, and people that wonder what happened. Which one are you going to be?
I think I know which one we both are.
Mm.
We've talked a lot about EBM, and we've talked about some other stuff too, because we can. But do you have any other advice or ideas about EBM that you specifically want to cover?
Well, just that I don't think that people don't need to digest it all at once. It doesn't have to be, yesterday I didn't do evidence-based medicine, and today I'm totally committed and I'm taking on evidence-based medicine. I always reassure anytime I'm talking about evidence-based medicine that every single person is doing evidence-based medicine, because this is what I was taught is one form of evidence-based medicine. It's not a really high level of evidence, but it doesn't mean it's wrong. So just because you were taught to do something some way, and that's sort of eminence-based medicine, doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means it's eminence, and we could have higher levels of evidence and higher confidence in it. But it doesn't mean it doesn't make it wrong, and it doesn't make it right. And so, you know what? Everybody listening to this is practicing evidence-based medicine. You're already doing it. Now just up your game. Do it a little better. Learn a little bit every day. Think about those checklists. Think about some of the biases, and then slowly over time, I didn't all of a sudden, whoa, Ken was born and he did evidence-based medicine. There's a story about standing on the shoulders of giants from Newton, and maybe we'll talk some other time about where that story came from. But I have stood on some really, really amazing people like Dr. Andrew Worster, Dr. Jerry Hoffman. I'm name dropping here, but there are some legends of emergency medicine, Rick Bucata, a really good friend of mine, Chris Carpenter. I mean, I have leaned on these people, asked them for advice, and they have shown me the way and made me a better physician. And so don't try to do it all at once. Reach out. There's a lot of friendly people out there. I'm happy to help anybody who reaches out to me, and we should pay it forward and share our knowledge, just like FOMED is wanting people to do, that it's free, open access to medical education, no paywall.
You are, I believe, today one of the leaders of, at least one of the big faces of evidence-based medicine. Because a lot of us on our different podcasts, there are many great podcasts, and I try and endorse which ones I can on Totally M. And I think that's one of the things that we have a responsibility of as people who provide FOMED resources, is that we should also be helping name drop in some ways what other good FOMED resources are out there, because it's hard to sometimes when you start out finding the right things to listen to. And I got very lucky when I started. I'm going to briefly talk about it here real quick. So when I started out, I kind of went off the deep end, and I was trying to find resources, and I was listening to MCRID, I was listening to ERCast, I was listening to SGEM pretty early on. I have to admit that when I saw Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine the very first time I saw it, I thought, oh, this must be someone who doesn't like emergency medicine. Then I finally listened to the podcast and realized that's not the truth at all.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's a nerd, and he's stuck in the 80s.
Hey, the 80s was a better decade in some ways than what's going on now. But the big thing is I feel like we have great resources out there. It's just sometimes a trick to do it. But I don't even listen to the radio hardly at all anymore, unless my wife's in the car or something else, because to me, I've got 30 to 60 minutes worth of driving ahead of me at a certain time. I'm going to listen to a couple of podcasts. And I'm not saying that everyone has to do that. I tend to, when I do something, I go all the way and get it all done. And for me, FOMED is one of those things. I love it so much, and I get so much information that what else am I going to do in that 30 to 40 minutes at a time, or up to 60 minutes or more? Well, I'm going to listen to some podcasts. I'm going to try and figure out some information, find the stuff that I believe is relevant to me, look it up later, digest it a little bit more, and go from there.
Turn your car into the classroom.
Well, Ken, that is all amazing stuff, and I think heads may start exploding in the background if we get too much more, but you're so full of so much knowledge. Is there anything else that you'd want to say?
Well, it's your 50th podcast, and I just want to say it's just been such a pleasure watching you start your knowledge translation project, start this foamy goodness that you're doing. And it's just been great. You know, like as somebody, you know, looking in and watching you grow and the product you produce, it's just been really satisfying for me. And so congratulations on 50. I hope you reach 100, 150, 200, and keep going as long as you want. But because it's 50, and because 5 is my favorite number, I want to give 5 take-home points, 5 messages I want to leave with people. Is that okay?
That is brilliant. Go for it.
All right. Off the top of my head, 1, EBM rocks. 2, use the FOMED. 3, when it comes to evidence-based medicine questions, the answer is, it all depends. The 4th thing is, the number needed to treat to help one patient in the emergency department is 1. We should be able to have a positive impact on every single patient we see. So the number needed to treat for benefit in our job is 1. And you know what the final point will be, don't you?
Be skeptical of anything you learn. even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, or totally am, right?
That's exactly right.
I guess with that perfect note, since we got your tagline in, do you think you can get our tagline in?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.
Thank you for downloading another episode of Total EM. We want to thank our bandwidth sponsor, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this show. You can also see them on our website, but we also have included links to their website, funnyrx.com. Again, thank you, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this episode.